Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. With us this week, Blair Horner, Senior Policy Advisor for NYPIRG. You can find out more at NYPIRG, NYPIRG.org. In the interest of full disclosure, Blair also does commentary for WAMC, serves on the WAMC Board of Trustees, and he's back again, called into service. Blair, we love you. Welcome back to the Capital Connection.
No, I'm blushing, David. Thank you.
Well, you know, it's that kind of love for a person who will come when you call him, unlike many of the politicians we try to get for this program, which I got to admit, Blair, you know, you've been at this a long time. You know, the days of Mario Cuomo when he would come at your beck and call because he wanted to fight with you about something or at least argue the philosophy or the principle of something. And many of the others, the attorney general of the state, I can remember a guy named Dennis Vacco way back in the day. A Republican would come on, and you see all these politicians these days are much less willing to interact with the press. Don't you agree?
No, it certainly seems that way. And, you know, part of it is the evolution of the communications world. I mean, it's much easier to get your message out to your followers than it was in the old days when the major way to do that was to go talk on a public radio station or to talk to the main, you know, the main media outlets that existed at the state capitol. Now you don't have, you can go right around them. So it's easier to get your message out, and it's an unfiltered message when you put it out yourself.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, because you would think, at least in public media, that there would be an obligation to sort of speak to the constituency. You know, you use Governor Kathy Hochul as an example. They were going to be the most transparent administration of all, and yet there's been some vetoing of FOIL bills, Freedom of Information, and there's also this idea that, you know, if you're going to be transparent, you should be out talking to everybody.
Well, I mean, they are public servants, and the public does deserve to know what their servants are up to. But, you know, again, it is a world that in the United States that is increasingly, the governments are increasingly less likely to want to do that. They don't want to face the tough questions, and they'd much rather, you know, again, communicate directly with their followers with an unfiltered message, and they don't have to, you know, there's nobody that sort of give them a hard time. I mean, you see it in Washington where the president now is pulling out of the White House press corps outlets that ask him tough questions and replacing them with outlets that are much less likely to do so. And, you know, that's part of the effort. You know, you want to put your message out without somebody asking you something tough that might change the narrative. And so it's bad. It's certainly bad because the public deserves to know what their elected officials are up to.
Yeah, it's what we call democracy, part of the whole package. Well, Blair Horner, we got distracted there for a moment, but let's get to the real issues for you and for the New York Public Interest Research Group. Your latest column, posting it. I mean, I don't know if you were writing it right before I called you or what happened, but there it is, right here, fresh off the presses. Big oil scores big profits and still gets tax benefits from New York. You know, I'm shocked, Blair. I'm shocked there's gambling going on here.
The great line from Casablanca. Yes. Well, you know, part of it is that New York State's tax code is, you know, often just piggybacked on what the feds write, or loopholes have been added because some special interest group is able to, you know, use their lobbyists to get something put in the tax code, and no one really pays attention to it. I mean, in New York, in a year, 800 bills pass into law. I mean, how many of those bills is the public paying any attention to? Now, that doesn't even count, you know, the gigantic budget bills, where that kind of interesting stuff can happen. So what we were pointing out most recently was how there are benefits in the tax code that benefit the oil industry, the fossil fuel industry. And, you know, the state's going to be facing a tough budget next year. And why should that be happening when the, you know, particularly big oil companies, the biggest oil companies, are making money hand over fist? We estimated last week that the largest Western oil companies plus Saudi Aramco made over $1.2 trillion in the period between January 2021 and the most recent filings this year. So they're making tons of money. And so why should we be giving them any tax benefits particularly if the benefits aren't doing anything to help the public. So that's, we think that'll be one of the issues we'll be spending some time on this year, is to try to see if we can end that practice.
You also cited a study by the New York State Comptroller. Tell us about that.
Actually, the commentary references two different reports. One is about the financial hit to local governments, and the comptroller's office estimated that nearly 600 deaths have occurred over the last 30 years due to the extreme weather changes that are occurring. And so that was one. And then the other was that local governments are going to be facing roughly half of their capital budgets will be devoted to projects that are the result of more intense storms and rising heat due to climate change. And so effectively, the huge portion of local government's budget is going to be devoted to things that cost money. Taxpayers have to pay for it. Meanwhile, the New York State tax code gives benefits to the oil industry, the same people that, were deceptive about the dangers of global warming and continue to this day to lobby against environmental protections that might do something about it. So, again, the comptroller's office, there's two different reports. One is sort of the casualty list, and the other is the financial casualty list for local governments.
But what's not there, Blair Horner, and which why I brought up the New York State Comptroller, is because the comptroller is responsible for investing the state's money, right? And that's they right. often invest in fossil fuel companies because they have a high return. Now, he likes to say he works from within to try to get them to change and adapt. But there's an issue there, isn't there, too?
Well, it's certainly an issue that the public should be aware of, because ultimately, again, the investments that the comptroller organizes into his portfolio are used to pay for the pensions of public employees who've retired. And, he's required under the state constitution to do it in a way that has the best financial benefit for those pensioners. And so this does come up periodically in terms of issues. Why should New York be invested in, the oil industry or the tobacco industry or in South Africa? And so those are the issues that the comptroller faces. And again, the portfolio is organized in different ways. It's partly what's called active investments, where the comptroller's office is making a determination to, invest in company X, and then sort of passive investments that are sort of like it's put into a fund that has a basket of a bunch of investments, and it's hard to cherry pick the ones out of those. So again, the comptroller has to face the music when he talks to the public, and he'll be doing that in 2026. And this issue will likely come up. There's expected to be a Democratic primary as well as a general election. And, this is the kind of question that will come up, and he's going to have to explain to the public why he can't do what advocates are urging him to do.
All right, let's move on. We're speaking with Blair Horner. He is the Senior Policy Advisor for NYPIRG. That's the New York Public Interest Research Group. Blair, why can't they make the bottle bill more convenient?
Well, the companies that are covered under the bottle law hate it. And now we're talking about the law that's on the books since 1982 in New York that says that if you purchase certain types of beverages that are carbonated, beer and soda, or water bottles, you pay a nickel deposit. And when you bring the container back, when you're done, you get your nickel back. And the theory behind that, of course, is it removes from the waste stream containers that ordinarily would have to be, dumped in a landfill or burned in an incinerator. And so that helps in terms of taxpayer costs as well as the environment. And it also brings back to the companies relatively clean product that can be recycled. And it's the most successful recycling program in New York. Now, the law has been on the books, as I mentioned, for decades plus, and it hasn't really gotten a modernization. So to your question about making it easier for people to use it, I mean, one of the things that they could do under New York state law, everywhere where they sell one of these containers is supposed to be a sign at the checkout saying you can bring it back. Many people don't know that you can bring it back to the retailers that sell it, and they think the only places they can do that is maybe a supermarket or a big box store or a redemption center. And, people may not feel like, it's not worth it for the three sodas they buy in a month to return it when they go back to the same place where they bought the soda in the first place. They could just bring it back. So that's a very simple thing. The state could enforce its own law and make retailers do it. We were involved in a survey where we found that 80% of the retailers that we looked at, about 300 statewide, 80% of them didn't have the sign, at least we couldn't find one, and that of the remaining 20%, half had the sign in the wrong place, and the other half did have the sign. So roughly 90% were not complying with state law. And so that's something that the state could do that would make it a lot easier.
Well, Blair, I've got one other thing here that came to me as a result of speaking with the executive editor of the Berkshire Eagle about a story there that has to do with what I think a lot of people see, especially in inner cities and city areas, nip bottles, these small bottles of alcohol that people can put in their shirt or their jacket pocket and take a nip from. Well, they're having the same issue there, and I guess it's the same here, is that the bottle bill doesn't include these nip bottles. And so this nonprofit was offering a nickel for everybody who turned in a nip bottle. And they got something like, you know, 16,000 in the first week or something like that. So, wow. You know, you have these loopholes in the law, Blair. You know, where are nip bottles in New York State?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. New York State, again, only covers carbonated beverages and water beverages. They do not cover non-carbonated soft drinks like iced teas or sports drinks, not covered under the law. And that's mainly because they didn't exist in 1982. And it doesn't cover alcohol outside of beer. And so nip bottles are often used as small alcohol containers, and so they're just not covered. Now, there is legislation to fix that. And we've been urging the governor's office to embrace that because their own DEC has said that the law needs to be modernized, and you can do. And the state's landfills are filling up, and the permits are running out. So it's like, why not do the obvious thing to help? It won't knock out all of the solid waste in the state. We all have lots of paper packages and lots of plastic that we use, all that stuff, and foods, you know, food products, waste products. It all still has to be disposed of. But this is a law that's already on the books, and all it takes is a tweak to make it work better, and you would deal with the nips.
Well, from the nips to independent voters, we're talking with Blair Horner of the New York Public Interest Research Group, and independent voters are up in enrollment, and in fact, unaffiliated voters in New York outnumber Republicans. I spoke with Steven Greenberg from Siena Poll last week, and obviously the New York City elections, Oran Mamdani, the coming gubernatorial election, which now features Lee Stefanik, among others, on the Republican side, running against Governor Hochul. But perhaps the biggest thing is voting and voter rolls. This is what the politicians are looking at and making their strategies. And the independents top.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a real change. It's been basically a sea change in what voter enrollments look like in New York over the past 20 years. There's been a dramatic shift, and it's really, as far as I can, I mean, you know, the number of Democrats that are enrolled has went up, and then it's been stagnant now for a few years. In recent years, Republicans have been more or less stagnant and a little bump up recently. But it's really the growth in voting voters are the unaffiliated voters. And they now, as you mentioned, there are more of them than there are Republicans. And yet the way the system is set up, under the state constitution, is the two major political parties run the elections. Now, that was put in the 1970s as a way to sort of reform the way elections were run in New York because you had to have the two parties agree. Nowadays, it often leads to gridlock. And what about all the other voters that are not in either one of the political parties? It's their elections, too. They have not a word. So the system definitely needs to be fixed in a way that would allow for the unaffiliated voices to be heard.
Well, and doesn't it impact the strategy? I mean, we see a person like Congresswoman Elise Stefanik, who's gone to the far right of the party, you know, as a Republican, and who has to win in a general election if she's going to beat Governor Kathy Hochul, assuming, you know, she beats her lieutenant governor, which I think she probably will in a primary. However, you know, what's the strategy there? Most politicians move to the center in a general election, and yet, you know, the party is to the right. You've got Long Island, you've got Upstate, which could favor her. You know, doesn't it really impact strategy?
Yeah, I mean, the unaffiliated voters tend to be moderates. Those voters make the difference in whether or not Republicans can win in major contests. So, for example, the Nassau County executive that just won, a Republican, Bruce Blakeman, won, and it was reportedly because he was able to, you know, get a sizable turnout from unaffiliated voters to vote for him. Republicans are at an enrollment disadvantage in Nassau County, not huge, but they are. And the unaffiliated voters made the difference. He won with 55% of the vote. And to appeal, to run statewide in New York, I mean, Republicans have to run the table with the unaffiliated voters because nearly half of all voters, registered voters, are Democrats. And so in order to win, you know, you have to do very well among your own base, but also among the unaffiliated voters. And I think that one of the arguments that Nassau County Executive Blakeman will be making, and he's dipping his toe in the water reportedly to run for governor himself, is the fact that he is pro-choice. And that was right. Similar to what Pataki was in the late 90s and early 2000s. And he's the last Republican to win statewide. It's been over 20 years.
Yeah, and the interesting thing to me in that poll, Blair Horner, the Siena poll, is that more New Yorkers want somebody else as governor than want Hochul back in the seat, at least right now.
Well, I mean, I think the public is just unhappy with the way the country's going and the way New York is going. And, you know, the governor, Governor Hochul, has been, you know, buffeted by having to step into being governor after her predecessor had to resign as a result of, you know, allegations and scandal. And so I don't think she's really ever recovered from that. I mean, she's always had sort of middling numbers when you look at approval ratings. That being said, New York is a blue state, and running this time around may well turn out to be a referendum on the president, President Trump, which will probably help Democrats and help with the turnout. Again, I think the strategy on the Republican side is, how do you come up with a package that is sufficiently pro-Trump that you don't lose the base and yet sufficiently independent that you can appeal to unaffiliated voters? And that's a very narrow needle to thread, and Republicans have not been able to do it since 2002.
Not to mention the fact that Zohran Mamdani, a Democratic Socialist, now we know it's New York City, but that's where all the people are. And they went wildly for him. He was very good on social media. He was able to get younger people. But, you know, he appeals to that issue of affordability, something the governor has made part of her policy. And she also endorsed him, of course. And you see now the president of the United States having a friendly meeting with Zohran Mamdani and basically saying, we agree on affordability. Even though you might argue for the poorest among us, especially, a lot of what's coming down from Washington is not making things more affordable.
Yeah, I mean, it's always hard to know exactly what's going on in somebody's head when they decide to do a meeting. You can ask the president of Ukraine about what happens.
Yeah,
you never really know with this current president how he sort of zigzags. It's certainly what he thinks is the right way to proceed. And again, you know, why he and the mayor-elect seem to have a good meeting is, you know, it could be like a million different reasons. It's sort of like a political game of Clue, right? You don't really exactly know where was Colonel Mustard in the library with the candlestick. So I don't like read too much into a meeting that goes reasonably well, but clearly the president wanted it to go that way for whatever reason. And what's been reported is they were able to connect around the issues of affordability and the importance of affordability. And so it could well be that the president, whose policies are making many things less affordable for Americans, was reaching out to someone who connected with voters on the issue of affordability. We'll have to see what happens. I mean, it may just be a blip. And when we look at this in the rearview mirror, it didn't amount to much, but maybe it will.
All right, instead of looking backwards, let's look forward. You know, the comptroller has said we're going to be billions in arrears going forward, the out years he talks about. Now, you know, assuming that the Affordable Care Act subsidies don't come through, you know, changes to SNAP, we're seeing food lines, what is New York going to do? Are we going to be in trouble as less money from Washington plus these projected budget deficits? What does New York do? Do we use a rainy day fund? You know, what happens going forward? I need you to tell us, Blair.
Well, you know, we'll see. I mean, the the out-year deficits, they're always there, and it's based on, you know, if everything stays exactly the same today, what will be the impact 2 years from now? And so that's not the way lawmakers think. They just think about it on an annual basis and how they, you know, cobble something together to get them through the upcoming year. And the state's budget for next year, which, you know, because of what was happening in Washington, is definitely going to be hurt by Washington's decisions to cut back on Medicaid, to get rid of the essential plan. And, you know, we'll see what happens with the Affordable Care Act and SNAP programs, although they did extend SNAP through next fall. It's going to have a fiscal impact, but the state is running, I think DiNapoli was saying, as much as $3 billion ahead on revenues than they had expected this year. So I think next year, what the genetic code of the governor and lawmakers will be, how do we cobble something together that gets us through the election, and then we'll deal with what happens next year. So I think that's the way it's going to go. And I think in the short term, unless something really blows up, I think that they're probably going to be able to figure out by, you know, a nickel here, a dime there, they might be able to cobble something together that doesn't have a significant impact on people this year, with hopes of looking at it, you know, figuring out what they want to do in 27.
I got to tell you, I'm shocked again that lawmakers are pushing the can down the road.
Well, you know, and part of it is you just never know what's going to happen.
True.
Right? And you're talking about billions of dollars. And so the projections, again, are based on status quo. Status quo will obviously change based on whatever the decisions are this coming winter and spring when they put together the next fiscal year budget. And that may, you know, have a positive impact, or the country may, rebound. Who knows? Now, that being said, it could go into a very deep recession, too. And that will make everything that much harder.
I've got part of the solution, and I'll chant it just like they did down in front of Kathy Hochul. Tax the rich, tax the rich. Showed up again in the Siena poll. Most New Yorkers want to tax the rich. You talked about the wealth of the fossil fuel companies and others. There's enough wealth around to perhaps help with some of these problems. And of course, Governor Hochul does not want to do that. She's indicated that, and that's certainly on Mamdani's list.
Yeah, I mean, how the mayor-elect chooses to proceed will be interesting. I mean, one of his predecessors, former Mayor de Blasio, had a similar idea about pre-K, universal pre-K for kids, and he wanted to pay for it with a tax hike. And after a rumble with then-Governor Cuomo, they ended up doing that. It's just that they didn't raise the taxes on the rich to pay for it. Now, so is Mayor-elect Mamdani going to approach it the same way? That's a good question. The current governor, has said she's opposed to raising taxes because I think she's concerned about how that plays out going into the November election. That all being said, I mean, the wealthy were the big winners in the federal budget that was put together under the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill. 70% of the benefits went to the wealthiest Americans. You can make a pretty good argument, therefore, why not, since the federal budget hurts New York's finances and the beneficiaries, many of whom live in New York, just got a big tax cut, why not use some of that cut to offset the impact on services in New York? That's a pretty good case to make. I think the country needs to talk about raising taxes on the wealthy, too, because the massive debt that the country's accumulating is, you know, and it poses an existential threat to the country. And ever since the Reagan administration, when tax rates got lowered, and they are significantly lower than they were in the 1970s, the country's been facing a growing, massive debt. Someone has to pay for it. And certainly the guys like Elon Musk, who just got a pay package worth $1 trillion, maybe those guys can pony up some money to help the country pay for its debts.
Well, you'll probably be shocked that I would be shocked if they did, even though it seems quite obvious. You see these billionaires who supported Andrew Cuomo and others in that campaign turned away by the general public, who said, no, we want affordability. So it's interesting to me that you have, you know, once again, this idea of the Bernie Sanders and the AOC and, you know, being a social Democrat is something that the more mainstream Democrats try to avoid.
Yeah, I mean, it's the campaign finance system You know, I mean, basically, thanks to the U.S. Supreme Court, you can't really do anything about wealthy individuals spending as much as they want. I mean, Musk reportedly spent $250 billion to help Trump get elected. And because of that sort of Wild West campaign finance system, the wealthy control the sort of the wealth primaries about who the candidates are. It doesn't mean they always win. And Andrew Cuomo being a good example. But you could chalk that one up to more of a flawed candidacy necessarily than him not having the resources to pull it off. So it's a problem. It's a country's problem. As long as the Supreme Court acts as basically interprets the Constitution's free speech clause to mean that the wealthy can spend as much as they want to influence elections, we're going to have these kinds of problems.
And yet, no matter what problems we have, the most positive man in the room will be Blair Horner, the senior policy advisor for NYPERG. I don't know how he does it after all these years of New York State government and politics. He keeps his head up, he moves forward, tells it like it is. Blair, it's always great to talk to you. I hope I haven't depressed you any more than I normally do.
Hope springs eternal, David.
There it is again. Unbelievable. Hooray, hooray. Another day, a chance to excel in every way. Blair Horner, thanks so much for joining us on the Capital Connection.
Thanks for having me.
Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.